honor of the Willowbrook State School.
I was so thunderstruck when I got to Willowbrook. I had no idea how barren, how empty, how filthy, how disease-ridden, how violence-ridden, how anti-medical, anti-professional the modus operandi of the institution was. And as I was working and as I was bringing my training and my capacity, my knowledge to the job, I became more and more abrasive to the status quo of that institution that essentially, you know, was very happy being an American concentration camp, which it was. And I was interested in making sure that the hundreds and thousands of people that were incarcerated in that place somehow received the best possible care that I was capable of personally contributing as a ward physician.
That's William Bronston, the doctor who sparked the movement to shut down Willowbrook and other institutions of his kind across America. We spend the hour with him talking about his historic battle and how it continues today. His book is Public Hostage, Public Ransom, Ending Institutional America. This is Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. September 17, 1987, marked the birth of a new era for New Yorkers with developmental disabilities as Governor Mario Cuomo declared the Willowbrook State School on Staten Island officially and forever closed. But that decision didn't just impact New Yorkers. It sparked the closing of such facilities rife with horrific abuse and violence all over the country. Today we talk with a man who started it all, Dr. William Bronston. In his book, Public Hostage, Public Ransom, Ending Institutional America, he tells a spellbinding tale of how he shut Willowbrook down and what that long-ago fight means for our privatized system of warehousing the disabled and elderly. Bronston says the fight isn't over. We need to end profit-driven nursing homes as well, or we all risk the horrors of institutionalization. William Bronston is a psychiatrist with a long history of activism for deinstitutionalization, Medicare for all, and other social justice issues. Dr. William Bronston, you are the person who was behind one of the biggest systems changes in American medical history, the shuttering of the Willowbrook State School, which ultimately led to the closing down of such congregate institutions around the country and their substitution with community-based group homes. I am so honored to have you on Writer's Voice. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Francesca, and it's mutual, I'm sure.
Tell us a little bit more about yourself. I mean, I know that you have organized minority hospital workers. You were the doctor to the Black Panther Party in New York. You're a fighter for single-payer health care and the great-nephew of Leon Trotsky, which really impressed me. So tell us a little bit more about yourself and what brought you to the work that you write about in this book.
Well, I've always, ever since I've been a little kid, wanted to be a doctor and wanted to care for people. It's just a burning, you know, kind of a sense of, in my interior. And my training in medical school was very alienating. And I was hugely concerned with the dehumanization and the isolation that the training, the mechanism of training in medical school. And so I put together at that time a large organization of student leaders from all around the country. We were roughly 10,000 of us under the aegis of a thing called the Student Health Organization. And we were concerned with addressing and ending the war in Vietnam. We were concerned with supporting the civil rights movement, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference at that time. And we were immensely committed to changing, humanizing our medical curriculum, that was included in nursing, dentistry, and medicine. The organization essentially operated for about 8 or 9 years. And in that time, I became heavily involved with a mentor by the name of Richard Koch, Dr. Richard Koch, who was the head of the Child Development Clinic Department at Children's Hospital of Los Angeles, where I lived. I grew up in L.A. in Hollywood. And Richard essentially had a team of various professionals, a psychologist, a social worker, a speech and hearing therapist, a public health nurse, himself as a pediatrician. And he invited families who had kids with suspected developmental delay to come to the clinic to be worked up, evaluated, and to provide comprehensive services to those families if the kid was found to, in fact, be slow, in order to keep them out of the institutions in California at the time, Pacific State Hospital, Sonoma, Napa, and so on and so forth. And he had a traveling clinic in order to demonstrate and role model to other communities this strategy of supporting families to keep their kid in the community and at home. And I grew up with that enormous influence. People from all over the world involved in child development came to visit Children's Hospital to see Dick's work. And so I grew up medically as a student, absolutely committed to community services and seeing congregate segregated services as ultimately evil and unacceptable and essentially an attack on family integrity. So I wound up by and by finishing my residency in psychiatry in Kansas and then moving to New York City. And after a couple of years, I was looking around for work. And because I was a very significant activist in a lot of ways politically, it was hard for me to walk in and get a job because people would check my background and they would see that I was, from their standpoint, a troublemaker. So I applied to a place called Willowbrook State School, which was a large institution in Staten Island, because I knew that my training and my understanding of human services and healthcare was grounded in this anti-institutional agenda. And they hired me. They hired me without checking my credentials or anything, because I was a well-trained physician and the doctors that were at Willowbrook were marginal professionals, you know, because of the nature of the work itself. Many of them were foreign-born, elderly, and very traditional kind of men and women. And I was so thunderstruck when I got to Willowbrook. I had no idea how barren, how empty, how filthy, how disease-ridden, how violence-ridden, how anti-medical, anti-professional the modus operandi of the institution was. And it took me a couple of years working there. And as I was working and as I was bringing my training and my capacity, my knowledge to the job, I became more and more abrasive to the status quo of that institution that essentially, you know, was very happy being an American concentration camp, which it was. And I was interested, you know, in making sure that the hundreds and thousands of people that were incarcerated in that place somehow received the best possible care that I was capable of personally contributing as a ward physician.
It's an incredible story, really. And your book, Public Hostage, Public Ransom, Ending Institutional America, is about more than Willowbrook. But
yes.
So I definitely want to get back to those larger issues. But first, you tell the story of a young African-American girl who was institutionalized at Willowbrook. I believe you begin the book with her, and now her name escapes my mind. But tell us a little bit about her story and how the institution of Willowbrook actually made her far, far worse.
Well, her name was Lillian, and she came from one of the boroughs of New York City. from a rather poor family, and her original diagnosis was autism. And Willowbrook was never a facility that by law admitted people with autism. They had to have mental retardation. That is, they had to have an IQ under 70, and they had to have other manifestations of intellectual and developmental disabilities. Because there was no community services of any kind in New York State at the time, the entire delivery system set up by the government were institutions, large facilities, larger than 200 beds, up to Willowbrook, which had more than 6,000 people incarcerated in it. And Lillian, because she was terribly, terribly isolated, as were all the people in the institution. I mean, I think your listeners have to understand and put themselves in a position of experiencing what it's like from age 5 or 6 or 7 to be put into a stone, large, filthy space with nothing to do day in and day out for their entire lives. Total abandonment, total deprivation of any kind of meaningful stimulation, of any kind of habilitation programming. And people are driven crazy by that emptiness, by that daily, minute to minute, hour to hour, week to week, month to month nothingness in their lives. And for a youngster with autism that already has major wiring issues and a variation in the way in which they experience the world, she was really totally abused in that situation. And when I got to Willowbrook, Lillian was in an isolation room. She was in a straitjacket around the clock every day, a straitjacket. She was tied up in a camisole, a canvas metal tied closed system where she couldn't use her arms or hands. And she just was absolutely wandering around the ward, you know, like some kind of a stricken bird, completely out of control and absolutely threatening the workforce, which only had 2 workers on a ward for 50 people, all of whom were doing nothing all day long and had to be drugged into relative insensibility in order to keep them from doing anything, to keep them immobilized, in lieu of having human staff working with them and interacting with them. So what happened was that one day I came to work and Lillian had this enormous swelling across her entire scalp that was so severe that her eyes were closed from the edema. And she had somehow hit her head and had developed this enormous injury. And the institution was unwilling to provide medical services to her in relationship to her injury because they just didn't care. I mean, when I say they didn't care, the magnitude of them not caring was criminal and violent in the extreme in terms of everybody in the institution. But Lillian, because she continually challenged the status quo because of her condition and her consciousness, was particularly threatening to the maintenance of order in the place, immobility in the place. And so I had to fight the institution doctors to get her transferred to Bellevue to be seen and treated because I didn't know whether she had a fractured skull. There was no diagnostic work that was being done, but the magnitude of her injury was enormous. I mean, I literally could put my finger down into 3/4 or more of an inch of edema throughout her entire scalp and face. And I had no idea what was the injury underneath the edema. And it took me quite a while in order to ultimately confront the system fiercely enough, professionally enough, to force them to transfer her to Bellevue, which was a major hospital in New York City, which was successful, and I got her out of there. And so she was out of Willowbrook for a week or more before they sent her back. And when they sent her back, Francesca, she was a different person. She smiled. She was calm. She was more normal than I had ever seen her before. Just getting her out of that hellhole that she had been thrust into since she was 5 or 6 years old, when she was first admitted to Willowbrook with an improper diagnosis. And she subsequently developed hyphemas, bilateral hyphemas, which is blood in her eyeball, that ultimately led to her becoming blind. And after a while, back at Willowbrook, when she came back, it turned out that there was no fracture, and that it was just a very severe head trauma that led to this swelling throughout her scalp and face. And little by little, when she came back, she became withdrawn again the way she was originally. But I refused to put her into a straitjacket, because the rule of the institution was that anybody that was in a straitjacket had to be essentially reaffirmed and signed off on by a doctor every single day. And I was still at that time just going along with the program, not knowing any better, not understanding what I was dealing with, not seeing the magnitude of corruption, fraudulence, and violence that was heaped upon the thousands of people that were incarcerated there from childhood up through elderly condition. And if you went into Willowbrook at any age, you were there to die. You were there till the end of your life, because the state received a tremendous amount of money from Medicaid to institutionalize 100% of the people in that facility, in every facility. And so it was drawing money. It had commodified this surplus population that had been pulled out of the working class, but was monetized, so that every day that she was there, like in a public school system where you get ADA money, you know, from the state, and the state of New York got money from the federal government in order to keep people incarcerated. And they were never repatriated. They became public hostages. And Medicaid was the public ransom, essentially provided to the state of New York for every single body there, every day they were in the institution, in the tens of millions of dollars. They were essentially never released, even though they were getting the ransom money from the federal government, because there was no programming in this monstrosity, and there was not a single community program in the state of New York at that time when I got to work at Willowbrook to begin with, which ultimately became the objective of shutting down this concentration camp once and for all, not fixing it, because it was unfixable, totally unfixable. It wasn't a residential facility. It wasn't an educational facility. It wasn't a medical facility. It was an American concentration camp where the death rate was 9 times the death rate of the city of New York, just because there was nobody looking at anybody in terms of dealing with the rampant medical and health issues that existed in this ultra-crowded, filth-ridden, dehumanizing, violent place. And the administration drove around in Cadillacs, and they never came to see what was happening on the wards. And so we as ward physicians were essentially responsible for managing and signing off and medicalizing and legitimizing the abuse that was going on in there. Every time a tranquilizing medication had to be given, we had to sign off. The nurses had to sign off if a person was in isolation or in a straitjacket, and every time they would give medicine. And the studies that we did showed that it was impossible for the workers there. There were only two nurses to any given ward that had 200 people. I came out of Children's Hospital where there was 800 of the top specialty physicians working in consulting relationship to the 150 beds that were at Children at the time. And I walked into this place and I was the only doctor. I had two RNs and two to three workers per ward of 50 people and four wards. I was constantly dealing with 200 people.
So William Bronston, in this book, Public Hostage, Public Ransom, as you mentioned, the public hostage being the patients and the public ransom being Medicaid, you write that this book is about the politics of human abuse. So before you said that, you know, you came in with certain expectations, you had a certain kind of naivete around you, but this case of Lillian really opened your eyes. You were disciplined around that, weren't you? You were taken away from the building where Lillian lived, and then you went on to try to reform the institution from within before you realized that was impossible. Tell us about your efforts. You wrote up a nurse, which kind of set off a huge reaction on the part of the administration. Tell us what happened.
You understand that places like Willowbrook and the country was laden with these large institutions because they were the default model of how to deal with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And so they were closed, they were secretive, they were isolated. You know, they existed away from and outside of civic community, out of society. And in that closed system, with all of the resources in there, all the drugs in there, all the clothing in there, all the food in there, there was a tremendous amount of corruption and dishonesty, because the workers, many of whom were poor people, diverse communities from Jersey and from the South Bronx and so forth, that traveled long distance because the pay of the state worker was very reasonable and there was very good benefits as a state worker. But in that closed setting, you built up a criminal force, not the majority of the workers. The majority of workers were wonderful and doing the best they could, except that the role modeling that they were essentially exposed to, you know, made them deeply part of the problem. But there were elements in those hundreds of workers. And at the time that I came to work at Willowbrook, there were 3,000 workers around the clock, 24 hours a day, throughout the day in three shifts. But the governor, because he wanted to build his marble and gold public office in Albany, cut the budget, froze the budget of human services in the state of New York, and a third of the amount of money that was going to human services across the board, mental health services, mental retardation services, housing, and so forth, destroyed the whole integrity, the fragile integrity that existed in these large institutions by losing one third of the staff that were there. So I was really struggling to try and provide the best medicine that I could, not only to the residents that were in the institution, the incarcerated hostages, but also to the hundreds and hundreds of workers. When I was on duty, taking care of the whole institution by myself overnight a couple of times a month. And so I got to know hundreds of workers, and the workers were as medically fragile in many instances as the residents of the institution. And so I was dealing medicine to take care of them as well, injuries that they had, illnesses that they had, because, you know, they were like family to me. I mean, I was one of them. I was one of the workers in the institution. The fact that I had an MD degree was just a happenstance of birth, you know, and location and race, you know. But the effort to try and be humane, loving, caring, attentive, interested, curious, you know, was part of what got me into terrible trouble with the institution, because they did not want change. When I insisted that if somebody died, there needed to be a case conference in order to look at the causes of the death, when we were dealing with the most rampant diseases of crowding and lack of public health, there was never any effort to try and address the illness. Anyway, I was moved from my initial assignment, which was in what was called the baby building, which had 200 people in it in four wards, to a smaller unit that was a demonstration unit that the institution used as a facade. And I had 134 preteen kids, both boys and girls, in my buildings. And after a year of working with them and working with their families, bringing their families in and interacting with their families in a very intimate, personal way, I was able to eradicate 100% of all the infectious diseases and essentially get total control of the medical situation so that it was no longer an active, dynamic influence on what was going on. And I proposed that we reorganize the building so that by that time, I was intimately familiar with the qualifications and the capacities and the personalities of all my workers that were in the building and of all the children in the building, which I was totally responsible for day in and day out. And what I wanted to do is to regroup the children in a way that would be able to build some kind of a home-like experience in the building and regroup the workers so that they were essentially matched effectively with the people that they were taking care of. Different workers had different skill sets and different attitudes and different competencies. So when I proposed this, my head nurse blocked the effort, and the chief nurse of the institution called in the administrator, who was already super annoyed with me for having moved me one first time already after, you know, a year and a half. And they moved me again. They transferred me into the bowels of the institution, where I was assigned a building of all grown adult women. And then 3 days out of five, I was responsible for two groups, 400 women, and often up to 1,000 women a day. So I got to tell you, coming to work, I had to somehow touch, physically put my hand on every single person to make sure they were alive, because the magnitude of violence and the overwhelming tranquilization of all of the people, because there were not enough workers as a result of the budget freeze, the job cuts, the loss of workers, and the overcrowding to begin with. Willowbrook was not accepting residents other than through bribery, because there was illegal viral research going on funded by the Department of Defense in hepatitis A and B and German measles that were going on without any meaningful agreement on the part of the people there. This was before laws were passed in order to assure understanding and an agreement to be part of an experimental program. And this was being essentially operated by the top virologists in the world. They were using the institutional population because they didn't have to get consent for their research. And they had no idea what they were giving to these people until the experiments were essentially, you know, mounted. So they could be providing death-dealing amounts of virus, you know, without realizing it at the beginning when they started this work. So I was constantly documenting. Every time I would take care of somebody, I would explain in writing, in the record, which were barren other than accident reports, what was going on, what the causality, what the problem was, what the context was that led to the problem that I was dealing with that particular individual. One of the things, for example, was that I was constantly called to suture gashes and injuries. You know, I probably sutured two or three people with major cuts and gashes every day because of the overcrowding and because of the violence and the hardness of the wards. The wards were terrazzo floors, super high ceilings, no sound, you know, management. The people in the institution were never allowed outside their buildings because there wasn't adequate coverage, staff coverage, to have a worker essentially chaperone X number of people out into the outside, as opposed to keeping them in the building where there was only two workers per ward. And you couldn't leave the ward with only one worker on the ward. So people were literally incarcerated for their entire lives in these terrifically echoing, filthy, hard spaces that was essentially the interior of these gorgeous two-story and one-story brick buildings from the outside in this gorgeous country-like, you know, environment that the institution covered roughly 350 acres, beautiful trees and everything. But the interior of these buildings were absolutely savage, barbaric in the extreme. So the institution kept essentially punishing me, and I had to obtain a lawyer. I was very lucky in getting the top labor lawyer in New York City on a pro bono basis to defend me, Gene Eisner. And we appealed that they moved me on a punitive basis rather than on a legitimate basis. And little by little, my colleague who I recruited to work with me in the institution on the male side, I was on the female side, we began intensely to interact with the families personally, intimately, in order to bring them into the buildings when they came to visit their relatives that they saw deteriorating physically and emotionally and behaviorally at a drastic level, in order to show them why their relative was so traumatized, so damaged, so primitive in terms of what was going on in the way they ate, because there were no utensils, the way in which they toileted. They had no clothes on the inside of the institution, and people were in large part naked, and the clothing were rags. I mean, the situation, Francesca, is beyond description. But what I wanted to essentially capture in my book was not only the specifics of Willowbrook and how I organized and addressed and recorded and documented the situation in Willowbrook, but to look at the larger picture, that the money that essentially enabled the state of New York to run this kind of criminal operation statewide was really the precursor, the harbinger of the national nursing home industry in America today, funded by Medicaid.
William Bronston. Stay tuned for more of our conversation about his book, Public Hostage, Public Ransom, after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. We're spending the hour today with renowned advocate for disability rights and Medicare for All, Dr. William Bronston. His book, Public Hostage, Public Ransom, tells the gripping story of his successful fight to shut down the notorious institution for the developmentally disabled, the Willowbrook State School on Staten Island in New York. It had a transformative impact not only on Willowbrook, but on the care for all the mentally disabled in America. I want to ask you about the parents, because you write so eloquently about the psychological dilemmas that the parents of these children, the parents of even if they're adult children, that they faced, and the way the parents internalized the blaming messages and the contradiction that they perceive between loving their kids and fighting for them. Talk about that.
You understand that if all you have is one programmatic alternative in the entire state of New York, and they are all institutions, and they all are doing the same thing in terms of providing this totally barren, totally violent, totally disease-ridden option, that you have to be very careful about challenging the system for doing something wrong, lest you somehow have your kid put back in your hands, which you can't manage at home because of the need to work and skill sets and the abilities of parents to be able to handle their children that are very complicated behavioral and emotional and physical kind of realities. And so the family organizations, the Association for Retarded Citizens at the time, ARC, which was the principal large organization. There was also a Down Syndrome Congress. There was an autism organization. There was a cerebral palsy association that exists now. But these organizations, because the state only provided one horrible option, had to, on their own recognizance, provide services of last resort for the sons and daughters of their members. And to that extent, freed the state to continue to be the abysmal criminal resource that it provided, and complaining or even knowing about what was going on that resulted in the destruction of their sons and daughters was terribly, terribly threatening. People are very gentle. And the whole stigma and stereotyping of having a kid that's different in our culture is a very injurious, status destructive phenomenon in our society. If somebody finds out that you have a kid with special needs, your status, your caste identity in the culture declines. And the families were stricken with guilt about having a kid that was different in the first place, living in a very superstitious society and culture in general, and essentially were paralyzed from challenging the state. Those people that interacted with the institution, and they were a tiny minority, got special kind of token benefits from the institution through familiarity, and they did not want to essentially call the institution to task for the horrific reality that was the day-to-day experience of their children.
But yeah, you were able to, in a way, transform many of these parents.
Absolutely. I mean, all we had to do, I mean, first of all, I sat and cried with them day in and day out. I mean, the stories, the suffering, so moving, Francesca. I mean, the experience that these families were going through with their children and the implacable cruelty of the institutional personnel, not because all of them were bad, but the people at the top were definitely bad, and they essentially maintained the status quo. And so Mike Wilkins and I, spent a tremendous amount of time bringing individual parents into the buildings when they came to visit their kids, and very few did at the beginning, and then began to introduce parents to each other to discover that they were all experiencing the same bloody situation, and that the institution had to be somehow held accountable and to repair the situation that was artificially created for their sons and daughters in the institution. And little by little, as more militant parents became involved, the anger, the conversion of their guilt and shame and insecurity and uncertainty was converted into a clearer understanding that there were human sources for their misery, for their suffering, for their humiliation, and for the damage to their children, and that that had to be stopped. It had to be addressed and stopped. And so the power of the parents as they began to meet each other became really profound. And then Geraldo Rivera, when the institution fired my colleague for refusing to not meet with the parents on the building grounds, which both of us were doing, and because he did not have the time in the institution to make permanent his appointment, they fired him. And we had this lawyer friend of ours who we were working with, whose name was Jerry Rivers. This was before he became Geraldo Rivera at ABC television. And so Mike called Geraldo up and said, you know, I've just been fired, and this is a situation you've got to come and see. And Geraldo came to Willowbrook with a camera team. And Mike, of course, toured him through the buildings. And Geraldo was just floored. He was overwhelmingly moved to the core at the horror that he saw, and had this enormous struggle with the leadership of ABC television in order to show the footage. And it was finally shown and became atomic in terms of impacting the general public in New York State and all around the country. That documentary that he did was so powerful. And the result of that was that the parents who saw this validated in public media, were immensely strengthened in order to confront the institution. And we then built the foundation for a federal class action lawsuit for crimes against humanity against the governor and the state of New York in order to shut this monstrosity down once and for all, not fix it, not invest in it, because it was absolutely not fixable, to shut it down and to open up a whole strategy to build community-based smaller services that had no more than 6 beds in any given situation, which of course was never fully achieved, because the country has as its default institutionalizing its unwanted and surplus population, all of which are funded by large Medicaid daily amounts of money, $200, $300, $400 a day that comes in from the federal government to incarcerate people that are different.
So we will go on to that now, but I just want to say that I'm old enough to have seen that documentary, and it was seared into my memory.
Yeah, it was atomic. It was atomic. And then after that, you know, the institution red baited us. They used all of their churchmen that were in the institution, the rabbi, the Catholic priest, the Presbyterian ministers, and so forth, with three page long, unsigned, red baiting attacks on Mike and I that were distributed through all the churches in Staten Island. And we were so worried that our house, I lived in a group of other doctors, 7 families on a square block in a large 3-story Victorian. And we were afraid that because of the caliber of the population in Staten Island, which is very, very conservative, that we might be bombed. And so Malachi McCourt, who was one of the families, one of the parents that had a kid in the institution, Malachi is very famous, his brother, Frank McCourt, major author. So Malachi essentially arranged for us to be on the Dick Cavett Show within a week. And I read the full document that the institution wrote anonymously to distribute into the church system in Staten Island on national television. And they interviewed the public relations director of the New York State Department of Mental Hygiene and the new commissioner of mental retardation, who came in black spats and 3-piece suits. And Geraldo was on the show. One of the residents, Bernard Carabello, with cerebral palsy, and his mom were on the show. Diana McCourt, Malachi's wife, because Malachi and Diana had a youngster in Willowbrook at the time, because there was no alternative. And Mike and I. And it was a rout. I mean, it was one of the most dramatic Cavett shows ever imaginable. And it seemed like everybody in the nation saw that interview. And then things immediately converted into the campaign to mount the federal class action lawsuit, which was being essentially engineered by the American Civil Liberties Union and the New York Lawyers Guild leadership. They've been working on this for a long time, but it took the development of these crises of Geraldo's expose, Cavett's show, in order to get to the place, all of which, by the way, is photographed and described in my book.
And the book is Public Hostage, Public Ransom, Ending Institutional America, and we are speaking with the author, Dr. William Bronston. So now let's go to that other part of the book where you widen beyond the example of Willowbrook to talk about the institutionalization of America and the threats really to all of us with this. So tell us now, how does a system work? How does it work to so corrupt the public welfare in the institutionalization? I mean, we don't have the kind of institutionalization, thanks to you and Mike, that we had back then of people who have developmental delays. But there's plenty of institutionalization to go around in this country.
The reality of the situation is that we face today three overwhelmingly strategic challenges to our survival. One is climate change, one is healthcare, and one is poverty. The developmental disability community and the mental health community essentially receive small stipends from the federal government under the aegis of Social Security, the Social Security legislation, which established Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare is a program that was set up in order to provide health care services in part to elders and to people with disabilities of major sort. Medicaid was set up to provide third-rate medical services and financing for poor people in the United States. But the fact is that the rates created in the Social Security Act, Title 19 of the Social Security Act, which was enabled in 1964, essentially is inadequate. And the profit rate system in the medical community exceeds the Medicaid financing system. And so you have a system that essentially is providing resources to these congregate segregated facilities. Healthcare is a critical need for this population. And to the extent that they essentially surrender their Medicaid eligibility, they're essentially SOL. I mean, they're in a position where they cannot, you know, function. And the need for essentially ending this third-rate system of financing coverage, which leads to institutionalization, because Medicaid was set up not to fund families purposefully by the Congress when it was established, because it was at the height of the Cold War and the Congress was concerned about Bolshevizing, quote unquote, the American family. And so the policy decision was made in law to only finance facilities, not people. And so the result of the whole medical coverage system is that the feds finance institutions, facilities, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, hospice programs. And that money, in large part, goes to, at least one third of it, goes to administration, goes to middlemen. So the result of that is really devastating, because unless we have universal, rightful, single-payer health coverage that essentially changes the ownership of the medical delivery system from corporate-owned to publicly-owned, we will continue to have these incredible, devastating realities that all of us experience. And the translation of that is that even though the large institutions like Willowbrook and Brooklyn State Hospital and Pacific State Hospital and Napa and Sonoma and so forth have essentially resulted in their, in large part, closing or major reduction in their size, the reality is that the alternative funding, the continuation of the Medicaid funding, has led to this gigantic nursing home industry, which is the default for the last 50 or 60 years as a result of Title 19 policy and financing that threaten 100% of the population. We are all destined, unless we're extraordinarily wealthy, to end up in congregate segregated institutions, dying earlier, sicker than any other country on earth. We are number 41 in the world in terms of morbidity and mortality statistics, in large part because we don't have a rightful single-tier medical care that has a single financial trust fund at the public level to which all billing by healthcare professionals essentially is aimed and funded. And that's the big story here. The story of Willowbrook is nothing more than an introduction to show people what it means to be in an institution. And when COVID broke out, I'm sure people know, 40% of all the deaths in the country came out of congregate segregated institutional systems, both for the residents in those nursing homes and the workers in those nursing homes who had to go to work and didn't have the protection and were involved in these crowded, inhumane, dehumanizing situations.
And I want to point out also, you talk in this book, William Bronson, in Public Hostage, Public Ransom, about the involvement of the financial system, the banks in Willowbrook. Now we have a situation where private equity firms are taking over the nursing home market. I wonder if you could talk about the impact that has on an already abysmal system.
So let's start earlier on and relate to the issue of the financial institution. So Nelson Rockefeller was the governor of New York during this scandal. You know, Nelson, the one who essentially killed all the people in Attica, you know, essentially never came to Willowbrook to see the scandal and so forth. But his brother, David, was the head of the Rockefeller financial empire, which included, half a dozen of the largest banks and security organizations in the United States. And so all the contracts that were essentially engineered in those days to construct and expand the institutional system had to go to the financial community from brother to brother in order to get the state financing of the loans made from the banks to the state to build these institutions. And so you have the same situation going on now, where in large part, the opportunity to be able to privatize, corporatize all these small, what were originally nonprofit institutions for us, for all people as we age, essentially is now seen as a major source of profit. And the federal government is at some level collaborating with the private sector in order to alter all of our financing eligibility for long-term care, which is the Medicaid system, long-term care finances facilities that will essentially not be told to us as we are automatically shifted from an accountable delivery system, notwithstanding its inhumanity, to a private system that is enormously profitable because the financial community that essentially is buying up and owning more than 70% of all of the congregate segregated facilities in America is there to make a profit. And at least a third of the money that is being used is not going to care, but is going to administration and profits and CEO, you know, mega salaries and so forth. So the situation is terrifying, and it is deadly dangerous for the American population. And unless we as a people, through direct voting, essentially establish plebiscites or propositions to change our system from a congregate, segregated, corporate-run, corporate-owned medical market system, not a healthcare system. We do not have healthcare in America. We have a medical market system. If you use the term healthcare to describe what we have, you essentially cloak, you hide, you confound an understanding on the part of the general public of the need for a true healthcare system, which, if we had one, would be administered by the Public Health Administration in America, which is a vast organization that essentially is being massively defunded through the influence of the corporate equity system that is owning all the hospitals, that essentially owns the insurance industry, that essentially owns the pharmaceutical industries that are these mega multinational organizations that are all driven by profit and money, not by health. It's profits over people. And the magnitude of the problem is essentially dramatized in the Willowbrook situation in the most dramatic kind of a way, but has to be understood as a metastatic problem. Willowbrook is a large, giant cancer, but the metastasis from that cancer has essentially established a private nursing home system in America, assisted living, hospice care, regardless of how elegant it may appear. When you put devalued people, surplus population, because of their lack of caste value, into a congregate situation, you essentially destroy their identity, destroy their protection in our society, and essentially consign us all to a premature, miserable, dehumanized ending in these institutions. And so we must somehow understand the gravity, the universal reality of the threat to 100% of the American population as a result of the privatization and the massive construction and utilization of congregate segregated facilities in order to take care of us as we all age.
Well, William Bronson, I recommend your book, Public Hostage, Public Ransom, to all my listeners. It is a gripping story. This has been a gripping interview. I want to thank you so much for joining us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much, dear.
William Bronson. Go to writersvoice.net for links to Geraldo Rivera's reporting on Willowbrook and more resources on the fight to end institutionalization in America. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. Stay connected with Writer's Voice. Find us on YouTube, Facebook, X, and Instagram. Just search on Writer's Voice. Or go to writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.